Welcome back to the Access to Education podcast, where we talk about all things having to do with learning challenges and learning disabilities. When we have children who are struggling with ADHD or other sensory and neurodiversities, their ability to deal with big emotions can be hard. We don't always understand as parents why they feel the way they feel. Emotions can come on hard and fast. Being able to help our kids navigate that part of life can be a challenge. I know for myself, oftentimes it's as much about regulating my own emotions to situations as it is about helping them. Today on the show, a conversation with Rachel. She's a parenting specialist who has been serving families for over a decade. Besides being a mother of two, she also has a master's degree in clinical psychology, a certification in positive discipline, and has provided services as an ADHD coach, in-home mentor, and therapist. Through her podcast, programs, and services, Rachel teaches parents hands-on tools for raising resilient, confident children and bringing flexibility, peace, and connection to the families. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here.
I've done a couple of conversations about big emotions. I feel like it's one of those conversations as parents that we can have over and over. You can't have this conversation enough.
I agree, because we so often fall back into old habits. Like, we learn something new and then we go right back to our old reactions. It's really hard to remember to do the things that help kids with big emotions.
Well, and I find as my kids age, the big emotions, the way it comes out changes. So I then have to change, like, the thing I was using before doesn't, it's like when the baby learns to sleep and you think, sweet, we got it. And then they go through another milestone and then they regress in their sleep and you're starting all over again. So it's very much, at least in my house, I don't know if it's that way in other people's houses, but it's definitely that way in my house.
Absolutely. Parenting is, you think you've got it. And then you have another child who's, it doesn't work with them. And then they go through phases and stages. And yes, exactly. Parenting is, it keeps you on your toes always.
Well, and what's interesting for me is I had two boys and then a girl. And I do find, and I don't do this on purpose, and it wasn't the way we set out to do it, but I do find the way that the emotions come out in my boys is quite different to how my daughter experiences emotions. And it's, mm-hmm. I didn't think they're just children, mm-hmm. but it, yeah. And the way we talk about it and the depth in which my daughter will go into her emotions and how she's feeling versus my eldest son, who just like, I'm fine. Now he's almost 13. So that my
that's a part of it. That is definitely part of it.
But when he was little, he wouldn't. Whereas my six-year-old, my little girl, she's like, oh, and I felt this way about this and somebody did this. And anyhow, it's very interesting. So let's start the conversation by framing. I mean, we've just talked about it a little bit, but really, what are big emotions? I think we use that term and I'm not sure that we always understand what quote unquote big emotions are. So can you tell us a little bit about them?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you asked, because big emotions implies that they're loud and meltdowns and tantrums, and they aren't always. So let's start with the ones that probably you think of when you hear big emotions. It's the emotions that kind of come up out of the blue, like your child is fine, and then all of a sudden you give them the wrong cup and they melt down. Or, you know, they are expecting one thing and it doesn't go that way and they kind of freak out. Kids with big emotions also tend to be a little bit controlling and bossy. And if things don't go their way, they get really upset and you know all about it. But it could also be, I call big emotion kids sort of deep feelers, and they could feel more quietly. So some kids have big emotions, but they're just, you can see it because they're sensitive to criticism, or they get really upset if an animal gets hurt. They're not necessarily like being loud about it, but they still feel really deeply. And so they're a child who worries a lot, isn't necessarily loud, but they're also feeling things really strongly. So big emotions are basically, in my mind, kids who feel deeply and maybe a little less flexible. They have trouble with transitions and things like that, but it's not always loud.
I have one of each. I have a loud, angry, outbursty. What just happened? Oh, his brother just this morning dropped the raspberries on the floor, and it was this big thing. Oh, how dare you drop all the raspberries on the floor? Right. Rah, 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 and it was this big thing. And then yesterday we were on a road trip up to our family cottage, and there was a little bit of stress happening. And he, my middle son, was sort of very withdrawn and quiet. Yep. And he was just sort of pacing back and forth quietly. And so I have the spectrum, right? I have the loud, and like, you know, when he's really angry and you can, it's all in his face. It's in his body. It's like, we used to call it spaghetti, where he was like solid rock, uncooked spaghetti. He was just, you could see it from top to bottom. And then you'd see the outburst, and then it's the like, oh, the soft spaghetti, right?
That's exactly.
And then I have my quiet one, right? He just
that's exactly right. And he just paces as well. Yeah.
It keeps it interesting. If we didn't have differences, I think we'd be very bored with our parenting.
That's right. That's right. It definitely keeps us on our toes.
So why do we, and maybe there isn't an answer to this one, but why do we tend to see big emotions? And I think when I ask the question, I'm thinking more of when I grew up, I'm an 80s kid. I don't remember much of that conversation. I think, you know, there wasn't a lot of talk about your emotions. It just wasn't something we discussed, and growth mindset, all of those things were not top of mind. They are now. And certainly through this last two and a half years, mental health and those things have been big. But why is it that we're hearing more about big emotions? Why is it that we seem to be seeing it in little ones sooner? Is there something that has changed, or is it just, I don't know, evolution? I don't know. Maybe there isn't an answer, right? This is probably one of those like, don't know questions, but.
Well, I actually think there are a lot of answers. I think, first of all, we know a lot more. And so our parents kind of, and I'm an 80s kid too, our parents kind of just push the emotions aside thinking, it's not a big deal if we push them aside. Now we know that it actually is a big deal because our generation is not doing so well, mental health wise. So when you push them away, it doesn't actually go that well. And if you think about it, you know, based on, I know two generations ago where I live, it was the Depression. And so those people really suppressed their emotions. Otherwise they would have just really not made it probably. So there was all this and war is going on. And so there was that, we push it down, but we didn't realize the impact that it had. And it really truly does. So we know more now. I do think also, you know, if you ask that question about ADHD, why is there more ADHD now? Well, we know more now. It's the diagnosis is there, but there are also cultural factors that obviously play a role in this as well. So it's a lot of things, I believe.
I wonder too, if it's some of the societal pressure that we have now. I mean, when I was growing up in the 80s, and it's funny because I've seen a couple of like TikTokers put this sort of voiceover on of like, can you imagine if all of my mistakes as a kid were put on social media, because it's so common now for us to see it. And I think that pressure to be socially not acceptable, that's not even the word I'm looking for, but socially aware and with it and the perfection of that and the view that Instagram gives you on a person's life. And I'm very aware of, you know, when I use my Instagram for my access to education business, I mean, yeah, I'm not, you know, showing up in my pajamas with my hair all over. Like I am trying to sort of portray that I'm put together when maybe I'm not put together that day. I wonder, does that influence some of the emotions that we're seeing?
100%. And I actually do a workshop on raising kids with healthy self-esteem. And I talk a lot about social media and the pressure there is. And what's ironic is this was before COVID more so than now. What's ironic is that there's more pressure on them, but there's also a lot of parents who are trying to protect them. So especially before COVID, I would talk a lot about parents are like not allowing kids to feel discomfort. And at the same time, there's more pressure. So like I always ask the question, what about if I actually asked in person when I spoke in person still, how many of you could still get into the same college that you went to? And like even something small like that, the pressure to get into college, totally different. Like half the people said I couldn't still get in. So you have social media, you have the academic pressure, and then you had a lot of parents trying to prevent their kids from feeling any discomfort. So it's like this perfect storm of kids have all these emotions. They have no idea how to handle them. And then, yeah, there are these big reactions. And really what we see in the behavior is poor coping skills. That's all it is. Kids who like melt, you know, who freak out, kids who do the tight spaghetti, those are just poor cope. They don't know how to cope with those feelings. That's all it is.
And I don't know how to help my kid cope with it because I very much as a child didn't know how to cope with my own emotions right. And my own learning disability and my own insecurities that came with that, the social implication that had for me. I was in a small class placement that was away. I mean, I was on the other side of the school building from the quote unquote normal kids. I took a bus that other kids didn't take, right? Like all of those things played into how I grew up and felt and the internalization that I took in from that.
Yeah.
And then my kids are living a very different world with inclusion. And that comes with its own challenges, because sometimes when you are struggling at school and you're included in a regular program, as you get older, you start to see that you are more different than others, that you don't get it the same way. And I think that must play a bit of a toll on the mental and emotional well-being of that child as they go through the school system.
Absolutely. I actually was studying in graduate school the relationship between ADHD and self-esteem. And there's a huge risk when you have ADHD of not having really great self-esteem. Absolutely.
I don't, and listen, I can only talk from my personal perspective of my children, and every child is different. Every family makeup is different. Every situation is different. Every child comes with their own load. Every parent comes with their own load. But for my one son, being able to socially interact with friends is near impossible. A lot of what we did was sort of socialization groups to learn how to like enter into play with others and enter into these things. And I always thought it was ASD. I was like, he must be autistic, like the way he's so rigid and structured. And we had right at about 4 or 5 years old, that was like, no, that's not the thing. The markers are for ADHD. Wait till he's 6 or 7 and we'll figure it out. But then my middle child, who is just inattentive, he's not hyperactive and inattentive. So he's not the combined. He's extremely social, but you put him at school and you sit him at a desk and he like can't, you know, there's somebody over there who's sharpening a pencil and there's somebody over there who's sneezing and there's somebody walking in the hallway. All of that means that he can't focus on the lesson. Therefore he misses something. And so it plays on his own emotional toll.
Absolutely. And so if we actually just very briefly digress, although I think people will be interested in this.
Yeah.
Super quick. There are two components of self-esteem, and you'll hear why kids with ADHD or who are neurodiverse in any way may be at risk. Two components of self-esteem are, number one, a genuine belief that we are worthy of acceptance as we are, that we are worthy of acceptance as we are. Well, we're told all the time, if we're neurodiverse in any way, I mean, we're told all the time, even if we're neurotypical, but that you're not worthy of acceptance as you are. Something needs to change. We get made fun of, all those things. So that's the first component. We're worthy of acceptance as we are. And the second is, I am capable and can trust myself to do what I have to do. Well, if you're struggling in school, if you have poor executive functioning skills, which, you know, you need good executive functioning skills to do well in school, then you don't believe you're capable or that you can trust yourself. And they're always getting these messages, you're not good enough because you're not doing it the way that we're teaching you in school. So when those are the two components, you can see how there's a high risk for a lot of people to not feel good about themselves.
Okay. What are those two components again? Because I heard you, but I want to hear it again. What are the two components?
So the first is a genuine belief that I'm worthy of acceptance as I am.
Okay.
Not if I change, but as I am. And the second is a genuine belief that I can rely on and trust myself to do the things I have to do. So I'm capable. I'm competent.
It's interesting because I have one who feels very capable and competent, will do things independently all the time. And we always say, wow, like, great job. You did this, you did that. You know, I mean, even last night, he like loaded up the boat by himself, didn't need, you know, he did it. But I had the other one who's like standing there with the bin. And he was like, I don't, where does this go? What do I do? And it's funny. I was like, but we always, the one who has the struggle of believing in himself the most, we almost overemphasize when he does things on his own and we're proud of him. So interesting. And it doesn't seem to make a difference.
Sometimes, yeah, it's so interesting when you apply it to individual kids, because sometimes if we tell them how great they are in doing something where they're capable, if they don't have that self-image, then it doesn't actually convince them to feel that way. It just makes them feel more alone, less understood. So if a child feels, I can't look at what you did, and then they're thinking, yeah, but either that wasn't that great or they don't get it. In most situations, I can't do it. So that's how sometimes we, with such good intentions, don't really foster what we think we're fostering. It's so hard, isn't it, parenting? So
it does, though. But then how do we change the narrative for our child? Like, I don't know how I would change that, because I'm listening to you say it and I'm getting it. I'm like, okay, so I can't overemphasize when he does something well, because then he'll feel like, well, I can't get it next time, or this was just a fluke or whatever. Yeah. But then how do I help him instill the concept of, I am good at things, I can do things?
Yeah. So there are a lot of ways you can do this, but if we're talking about the capability piece, and I can also talk about the worthiness piece, that first component, but the capability piece actually comes from, I usually say there are a few ways you can teach them problem solving skills and practice problem solving skills. And I have a lot of actually fun ways to do that. For example, one of the games I used to play when I was a therapist with kids was I would just make up a hypothetical scenario. Like, you're in the airport and you have to go to the bathroom, but you have bags near you. How do you get to the bathroom? And then I would say, let's come up with all the solutions to this problem. And we would brainstorm all the solutions. So we're actually strengthening problem-solving skills. And I would do that with them on a regular basis. So then when they see a problem, they can actively figure out, because we've strengthened those skills on their own, they can figure out solutions to problems. Or another really simple way, this one's even simpler, that you can do in the moment. Let's say your child is struggling with something. Instead of saying, okay, I'm going to show you how to do it, or you're really great at it, I think you can do it, you can say something like, can I offer a suggestion? And that in itself is an empowering question. That in itself says, I trust you enough to know whether you need a suggestion or not. And if they say no, they weren't going to listen anyway. So you save your breath. If they say yes, what I usually do to try to build competence is I will say, okay, I'm going to tell you what I would do in this situation. And I want you to tell me all the ways you would change my suggestion to make it work for you. So you're giving them an idea, but you're ultimately helping them take ownership over that idea. And it's really not through words that we improve self-esteem. It's through skills and through how we treat them. That's how we improve self-esteem. Telling a child that they're great or praise, none of that helps. It's really, it has to be their experiences by how they're treated and how they feel they have the skills to do what they need to do. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It does. So what about the self-worth?
This one to me, I think we can make such small differences that have a big impact. So one example I give is often when we disagree with a child, like let's say one of your sons was mean to his brother. We often say, you can't do that. And what we're basically saying is your perspective is not the same as mine. So it's bad. And I'm not saying you do this at all. I'm saying most of us as parents do this. So a way to shift that is when our child does something we don't like, we can say, hey, I bet there's a reason you did that. We don't talk to our brother like that in this family, but I bet there's a reason you did that. What was going on for you when you did that? And then you can say, since we don't talk to each other like that, let's work on this a little bit. But instead of going and attacking what they did, we get into their world with them. And then we say, I bet there was a reason. We basically assume best intent. And when this is one of the big tips I give, when we treat our children with respect, especially when we don't agree with them, that is fostering healthy self-esteem. It doesn't mean we change our boundaries. It doesn't mean we're being permissive, because that actually isn't good for self-esteem. It means we have a boundary, but we assume there's a reason they didn't follow it to begin with, and we help them figure out what that reason is. That is how we treat them with respect, even when we don't agree with them.
Okay, so here's my question about that piece. So we know with some of our neurodiverse kids, ADHD in particular, the impulsivity of actions is an issue. So I have one who's incredibly impulsive, like will say things. And it's funny because since he was in kindergarten, maybe even preschool, but for sure it was kindergarten, two things would always happen. Before the yard duty teacher could get to the principal to say, so-and-so did this, that, and the other, my son had already made it to the principal's office to say, I did this, this is why it was wrong, and I should have done, and next time I will. So he was already able to do that. But what would happen is the consequence would be walking in the schoolyard beside the teacher, which meant that all of the kids at the school knew that he had been in trouble for whatever, which, good or bad, whatever, that's how they chose to deal with it. I didn't agree with it. I think there could have probably been a better way than that. But then saying all of that, how do we help our kiddo who is impulsive to then feel the self-worth, because he feels badly for what he's done?
That's right. So
and it's that guilt. He feels that, and he feels it like earnestly. You can see it in his face. It's the disappointment in himself, and it almost hurts me to watch it.
Yes.
So how do we deal with the impulsivity and still give the self-worth while still doing everything you just told me to do, which sounds lovely, but I'm like, I don't know how that would work.
So I do, because I was an ADHD coach for many years and I worked with lots of kids and teens with ADHD. And one of the basic principles of ADHD coaching, you probably know this, is we teach compensatory strategies and we do a lot of undoing shame. That's basically what I would do. Those are the two things I would do as a coach: undo shame and teach compensatory strategies. So what we want to do when a child is impulsive is, first of all, we want to give lots of do-overs. And we also want to think about how we talk to them after the impulsivity happens and saying, okay, let's try that. Because impulsivity, first of all, is one of the, you probably know this too, I'm preaching to the choir, but it's one of the executive functioning skills that takes the longest to master. I mean, you know this. It's like emotional regulation and impulsivity don't happen really until the mid-20s. They really don't. But we give them opportunities to do it over. And we talk to them about what was going on for them. When you did that, your brain was telling you this. Let's find a way for you to talk back to your brain, because your brain is naturally going to tell you to do that. So let's do it over now, so you have some practice. And then let's talk about, I create what I call when then statements. When this happens, then I will blank. And I would practice with kids when then statements outside of the moment. So when I see that someone is doing this, then I will. And we're basically teaching the brain, we're creating new neural pathways so that we can give the brain another option besides the impulsive option. But it's a lot of practice, a lot of repetition, and a lot of language. I always used to say this when I was a coach, ADHD is a reason, not an excuse. So we don't let it be an excuse, but we do say, you know what, your brain does do that. Let's help your brain. Let's give it all the options of other things that it can do. And we practice a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of practice. It's a lot of, I mean, we certainly did a ton of, and it was funny, and I've said this several times in the podcast, and I've interviewed the particular occupational therapist, but understanding how going to see an occupational therapist and learning about the body and the emotions and how that feels like and looks like and sounds like within their bodies. I mean, we just did it over and over. And I can remember in some of my most frustrated moments when there were really, really bad weeks, I would say to him, but we've done all of these things and you've done all this and we've learned all these strategies and why can't you just use them? You know, and as a parent, it's just out of frustration. It's not that I don't love him. It's not that I don't respect him, but it is a, like, we keep doing this. I keep banging up against this wall that you keep bringing me. And why? Now, as he's getting older, those when then statements, we certainly have been doing them for a long time, but they're more impactful now. I find as he gets into the teen years,
sure,
as he can more accurately sit with me, talk through it. And it's funny because we're doing a program at home, an emotional school program that we're piloting for a friend of mine. And it's funny, he'll bring up situations that have happened where he was impulsive and he can then say, oh, when I did this, I should have then done, right? Like he can backtrack it. It's quite interesting to watch the growth happen because when they're 6 or 7, they're kind of like, well, I don't know, I could have done, I don't know. But as he's getting older and all of his brain is beginning to develop and we're seeing, it's cool to watch.
Absolutely. And I want to go back to your point because they do develop and mature. Go back to your point that when they're young, it's so frustrating. It's so frustrating. And that's why when I'm working with parents of younger children, right, honestly, it goes back to us and our mm-hmm. expectations. And what can a young child really, what are they truly capable of? Because they may not be capable of what you're asking. So many of us set expectations based on what we want to happen, not what the child can actually do. So yeah. We set expectations. And what I always say about things like emotional regulation, because I talk about big emotions, is that basically, you're teaching a language that they don't know, that their brain is not wired to learn. And if you were teaching them any language like German or French, you wouldn't expect them to learn it right away. And in a moment of stress, they're going to default to their native language. They're not going to go, what's the new strategy? When they're like really upset, what's the new strategy I learned? Like, we literally need to create a new neural pathway where they connect this with the more mature response. And that is not natural to any child. So we have to set our expectations.
Okay, so this leads me into one of the questions I did have for you. And this is a really good segue into this one. So how much is the role of my own emotion, my partner's emotion, the teacher's emotion, the principal's emotion, the whoever the adult is in the space, or even the teenager, the older person to that child, does that influence or play into the child's ability to self-regulate?
So I have some bad news for us as caregivers, as parents, as educators. It is everything, unfortunately. And I am personally, and I don't know how you are, but I am personally what's called a highly sensitive person. I'm very reactive. You too. Okay. See, no wonder I get along so well with you. I'm highly sensitive. So I'm very reactive. And so I don't love this. But the way we actually regulate as human beings, we use co-regulation, especially for young children. So young children are wired to sense our energy, not our words. And parents always say, well, Rachel, I stayed calm. And I'm like, yeah, but were you really calm inside? No, your kids know that. So it is, whenever I teach emotional regulation for children, which I do for a living, it starts with the adult. It's co-regulation. We cannot expect them to regulate if we are not.
Yeah. So you want a really good example of that? And
I'm
putting myself on the line for all of the listeners. This is like a window into my world. So we were coming up to the cottage, as I told you prior to starting recording. We showed up at 10 o'clock at night. It was dark. The first boat that we tried to take to come across the water, because we're a water access only, didn't start. I was like, okay, this is not the end of the world. I know where there's another boat. We'll go over and get that boat. That boat was acting funny. So I was starting to be like, okay, it's dark. I don't know if the navigational lights are in. I know there's no power necessarily where we're going to. There's no water where we're going to yet that I don't know. Like all of these unknowns. fine, we get into the boat, the boat that we finally isn't working perfectly, so we can only go at half speed. The kids are tired, they're cold, they're hungry, they're getting mad at me because the boat's not going fast enough. And I'm like, okay, well, we're going to get, like, I'm trying, right? Like, I'm shoving it all down, being like, we're going to be fine. We get here, the water pump won't work properly. So I'm on the phone with my parents to be like, how do I get this thing going? I've got one kid who's cold, one kid who's like, I don't feel well because he gets motion sick. So we've got all these things swirling, I'm trying to get my partner to help me. He's trying to like manage the kids. Bananas. I lost it. I was no, and then of course, all of the children one at a time, right? Cascaded. So this is your point of like, if we can't be calm, then, and my husband is trying to be calm, but then I'm upset with him because he's not doing something fast enough. I perceive it to not be fast enough because he's not helping me. And then, so that was our last night. So it was.
Well, first of all, I'm so sorry to hear that, because that's a perfect storm of misery for you as a parent. Perfect storm. If you could have regulated in that moment, I would have been like, you're a robot. Like, who could regulate with all of that happening? I mean, come on.
Yeah, but it certainly did not help my high emotion kids. But I am very much like you. I consider myself not quite a super feeler, but I am definitely, I'm quick to emotion, and I have to bite hard to pull it in. And in times like that, I'm like, no, right now I can't, like, it, right?
And that's,
everybody
the
has their limit.
That we can't all the time. And that's one of the main things. So two things I work with parents is, how do we regulate ourselves? Because I'm not a natural regulator at all. So I teach strategies for that. How do we regulate ourselves? But also I say, you're not going to do it well all the time. And if you actually expect yourself to, that pressure in itself is going to dysregulate you. So I teach lots of repair strategies too. And lots of, you know, I actually think when we mess up, it's a perfect opportunity for kids to coach us on emotional regulation, which actually helps them as well. So we do the best we can, and we don't expect to do it right all the time.
And I do a lot of, like, when I have those moments, like I had last night, my middle kiddo was like, mommy, I'm still really stressed from last night. So we had a sit down, and we're like, okay, what were all the things that went wrong? And like, why were we right? And I take that opportunity as the parent to apologize, right? Because I think our kids need to see us do that, mm-hmm. to say, yeah, I got it wrong last night, you know, but here's what worked out. We got over here. We did get the water going. We did get the power on. We did get into warm beds. Like, we were fine. Right. So kind of the reassuring piece, but yeah, I work really hard when I do lose it a little bit, to kind of allow myself to be vulnerable in front of my children and say,
absolutely.
Hey, that sucked. And I'm sorry. And, you know, let's try and have a better day, and let's, you know, do some fun things together. And like, we were playing Frisbee and we were just sort of chatting and laughing and get right. Like, we try to move
on. That's a relationship. And what I always say too, is I actually was a therapist for teens with eating disorders, believe it or not, and early in my career. And I always said, when I was that kind of therapist, it was a red flag for me if a child thought their parent was perfect. Mm. A lot of kids with eating disorders think their parents are perfect. So they therefore think, I need to be perfect. Mm-hmm. We don't want our kids to think we're perfect. It is not healthy. We want to show, because what if we do have this like amazing relationship with them? We're always so calm and patient. And then they go out in the real world, and what are they expecting in relationships? That people are calm and patient all the time, and they're not. So that's why we don't need the pressure. We need to do the best we can, have the tools we have, and do what we can do. So that's all we need.
So we may have talked about this question, and you can just kind of say, oh no, you know what, Delphine, let's move on from that one. But what really is executive functioning? Because I think every time I talk to someone about it, they have a slightly different spin on it. And each spin, I think, helps everybody understand it, because it is the same, but the way they explain it is different. And I find for me, it makes a difference. And how does having a learning disability, a neurodiversity, a differently wired brain affect their ability to use a executive functioning like and I'm using air quotes, nobody else can see it, but like a normal child, right? There is really no normal. All children struggle with self-regulation, executive functioning throughout their lives. But what is the main difference with a neurodiverse child whose brain is wired differently because that's the way they were made? How does that affect their executive functioning?
So first of all, I just don't define executive functioning by the skills that we need to plan and execute responsible behavior, or the behavior we want to see in our kids, that kind of to meet goals and things like that. So that's how I define executive functioning skills. And when we with kids who struggle with some executive functioning skills that don't necessarily come naturally to them and they need to use some other strategies. Well, emotional regulation is an executive functioning skill. The ability to monitor your internal state, say, okay, I need to pause and I need to do something different and cope with this in a healthy way and release these emotions. I mean, all of that requires executive functioning skills. So when you have a child who is missing even one of those, what you're going to see is the behavior where they're yelling or they're aggressive or they're angry or they're holding it in and saying, I'm the worst kid ever, which also absolutely happens. Yeah. So, I mean, when you are wired differently, you simply, it's like saying if a child can't say 2 + 2 = 4, or maybe they literally don't know how to put those facts together. I mean, they just don't have the skill. So we teach them ways around that and ways that work for them based on their strengths. That's what I always used to do as a coach, but it's going to impact their emotions and their behavior tremendously. Because to me, behavior is only it's a symptom of what's going on inside. Behavior is a way of communicating how you're feeling inside. That's all it is. So you're going to see the behavior as simply what's happening inside of a child, which may be that they don't have some executive functioning skills haven't been mastered. And I would love to say one more thing too, because we don't always think about this with big emotions, but there are executive functioning skills required to like clean a room and turn your homework in on time and all those things. Probably all of your listeners know that. And what I find is that a lot of big emotions happen when we don't realize that the behaviors like I haven't cleaned my room, I've been mean to my brother or sister, I haven't turned in my homework. When we don't realize that that is poor executive functioning skills and we just get mad at the behavior, you see a lot of big emotions. So a lot of the families that I work with big emotions, I'm saying, let's back up and see where are your kids with their executive functioning skills. That may be the primary issue we address. And then the big emotions don't happen as much. Big emotions happen when a child feels helpless often. And so if we actually help them with their helplessness, you're not going to see those big emotions. At least they're not going to be as intense and the duration will not be as long. So it was a long answer, but hopefully that helps.
No, it's a great answer. But then I'm going back to the behaviors and how can we as parents help our children understand their behavior in a way that's age appropriate? Because as an adult, I can say to them, you know, I mean, one of the situations with my kid the other day was like, well, somebody said something to you that you didn't like, and you reacted in a way that was way over the top and it absolutely wasn't necessary. And like, you should have just walked away. But how can I backtrack with that behavior with him and revisit it in a way that is still going to keep intact his self-worth and keep his self-esteem kind of together and feel, like, how do we, because I'm like, that's all going through my brain right now. I'm like, I don't know how to do that.
I'm going to tell you.
Okay, good.
I'm going to tell you right now. First thing you want to do is go back to him and start in his world. The best question you can ask is, what was that like for you? Right. So we don't, when we're correcting behavior, which I think is super important, because remember, permissiveness does not lead to healthy self-esteem or resilience. We go back and correct behavior. We say, what was it like for you? Because that question is both treating them with respect. And also, I love this question. And I love questions like, what was bad about it? Or what did you hate about it? Because they tell us what the problem was. So if he says, well, what it was like for me is I was so angry that my friend did this. My immediate thought is, oh my gosh, you were angry and you didn't know what to do with that anger, did you? We can't. And then another question I would always ask is, did that reaction work well for you? Because a lot of emotional regulation, teaching emotional regulation with kids is getting their motivation and their buy-in. They're not going to use all these strategies we teach if they don't want to. So I always used to ask the question, I asked my own kids, do you like how that turned out? Did it work well for you? So first we say, what was it like for you, to try to identify, to treat them with respect and identify what was the problem. Well, the problem is he did this to me and I was really angry. And then I would say, did that reaction that you had, did it work well for you? And what I will tell you is sometimes they'll say yes. Don't expect them to say, no, it didn't work well. Sometimes they say yes, and you have to stay in that with them. You know what? I bet you did feel powerful when you got really angry. Anger is power. And in that moment, that probably did feel really good. And then maybe later, I would say, are there any problems with just using anger? Is there anything that you can see? Is there something you'd want to get that maybe you'd get if you didn't use anger as a strategy? So we have to really help kids see this on their own, because again, what that's doing, treating them with respect as if they're worthy of respect and helping them feel capable. So it goes back to that self-esteem piece.
Okay. I have a question that wasn't on my list of questions.
That's okay. Bring it on.
But I'm thinking about it now because I'm thinking about my eldest son's interaction with friends. And one of his friends a long time ago told, the friend told his mom, and she and I were friends and we talked often, and she was very kind to understanding my eldest and that, and her son was for a long time a good friend. But it eventually got to the point where he said to his mom, he's unpredictable in his emotions and I don't like it, which totally fair, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I think in life, if you are a person who can say, you know what, I'm not down for that. And I think that's a wonderful skill to have. But how do we, as parents of neurodiverse children, help families of neurotypical kind of bridge the gap and understand each other to be able to create positive social interactions? Because that, for my eldest, is really what has happened. He is an emotionally charged kid who is unpredictable. It means people don't often trust to be his friend because they're like, well, yesterday you were nice to me, but tomorrow you could like blow your top and then mm-hmm. we're all done. And that for me is hurtful as a parent. I mean, to be brutally honest about it, because he's the kid who never gets invited to the birthday party, right? Whereas my middle kid is invited to everything because he's not emotionally that way. He's emotionally quiet. People don't mm-hmm. see it. Mm-hmm. So how, I don't know, to the neurotypical parent listening, how do they support the friend who has a child with ADHD or self-reg issues?
Yeah.
But that, like, do you understand what I'm asking? I don't know that I'm asking it clearly, but I don't know how to get to that answer.
No, you asked it very clearly and I do understand. And I'm going to say two very simple things. One is, I'm taking this from Brené Brown, who I love. I'm sure most of your listeners know Brené.
She's amazing.
One of the quotes she has that I love is, you can't hate people close up. Not that I'm saying your son's friend hated him, but the whole point of that is once you understand people, you actually have so much more compassion rather than, oh, I want to separate myself from them. The second, so first is asking your son's friend if he wants to understand him more. And most kids honestly say yes to that question, especially if there is some sort of friendship or you know, there's something positive they get out of it, because kids are pretty egocentric. So if there's something positive, they'll say yes. And then the second part is science. Science is a friend, I believe. When someone doesn't understand someone and you just start to explain the science, why is his brain like that? How does his brain work? Has your brain ever worked like this? Well, this is, and I show pictures and I show, you know, because what I do a lot of is work with siblings of big emotion and neurodiverse kids to help siblings not resent their siblings. What I've said so far is ask if they want to know more, teach them science. And then the last piece of this, and this is just as important, and I do this with siblings, is really respect what that child is going through. The predictability is hard. And I always say that with siblings, don't just go to the sibling or the friend and say, well, you need to understand them because they're neurodiverse. You want to say to the sibling or the friend, how did this affect you? And what do you want to do about it? If this happens, what plan do you have? So it's kind of, like I said, three parts. Teach them, use science to do it because it's very effective. And then when you respect that it does affect them and they have a plan, they're a lot less resentful when it happens. So right. That was kind of a long answer. I hope that was helpful.
No, it's good. It's good. I think that, you know, I think the social interactions for my son is forever going to be the struggle, right? Yeah. And it leads to the isolation. It leads to the feeling of self-worth not being there.
Absolutely.
And that's hard to watch. And I'm sure there's lots of parents, you know, either listening to this or out there who watch that happen. And it's very, especially when there's siblings involved and one sibling has the social interaction piece and one doesn't.
I have the same dynamic in my family. And one of the things that I try to do, and I suggest to other people, and I know you've all thought of this, but one of the things I do a lot for my daughter is find similar kids. Mm-hmm. Because my older daughter has really poor social skills. She has very few friends. So first we talked about, do you want friends? And she did, because I'm actually a big believer, if a child doesn't want them, they're just introverted, right? And we need to step back. But she did. So we found a lot of interest-based friends versus geographic-based friends, because geographic-based friends are not going to understand. And then we found a lot of kids who were sort of like her, who were emotionally dysregulated often. And they bonded over that sometimes.
Yeah.
So I have an adolescent daughter who's going through this as well. That's what we do.
Yeah. And I think every kid is going to be different. And I think as a parent, I always say to my clients when I work with them, listen, at the end of the day, you know your child best.
Amen.
The teacher can tell you to do A, B, and C. The psychologist can tell you to do X, Y, Z. The doctor can say M, N, L. Like, it really doesn't matter. but you created that thing, or you were given, if you didn't create that child, you were given that child at a certain point in time, and you have grown to care for, love, and adore this person in front of you. And you need to say, that feels right, or that doesn't feel right. And if it doesn't feel right, I think we are both saying to you, let it go. It doesn't feel right. Move on and take the thing that feels right. Because if you do the thing that feels wrong, and I've certainly done it, you run up to a wall where you're like, well, why am I still doing this? And why did I think this would work? And then as a parent, you start to feel like, well, I'm a crappy parent. Clearly, I don't know what I'm doing. And in fact, you did. And so that gut check, that gut feel, I think, is so crucial in everything that is our children, whether they're typical or neurodiverse or somewhere in between.
I could not agree more. I think I always say a confident parent is actually more important than a correct parent. Not that there is any correct. There's no accurate, but we need to believe in ourselves and trust ourselves. And we do spend the most time with our children. We have a bond with them that no one else will ever understand. And even there, I'm going to be quite frank. There are a lot of parents who will say when they're feeling safe, I don't really get my kid. I don't really like my kid, which happens to all of us at some point very often, because a lot of parents I know will feel guilty. Well, I don't have a bond with my child. What do I do next? I still believe you know what to do next. And what I do a lot is just coach parents, and I ask them questions, but the answers come from them, not me. And they do know. I think there's a guilt in feeling like, well, I don't really like the way my child is, so therefore I don't know. And yes, you do. The reason you don't like your child is probably because you're exhausted and depleted, honestly. And you may not get them because you're not like them.
Yeah. That expression of like, you need to fill your tank first.
Yes.
It's such a key piece of it. It's hard. So, well, that's not true. I think for some it's easy.
Yeah.
For some it's hard. I will admittedly say for me, it is extremely difficult to fill my tank first. I'm always trying to fill everybody else's tank.
Yes.
And then like, oh, crumb. I'm like, there's nothing left in here for me. And then the reactions of, say, last night, right, bubbled to the surface because I can no longer continue to tread water. And it's funny, I was just talking to someone the other day and they're like, you always seem so calm. And I'm like, it's because you don't see what's happening underneath. Like, yes, you don't see the like
on top seems so calm, but underneath. Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of us parents, right? Where our feet are moving a mile a minute, but across the top, the surface, or we're the iceberg where you only see like a third of us. And then everything else is kind of buried underneath. And I think, I mean, I'm taking this from our conversation that we've had, but I think that's a lot of our executive functioning kids, where you see one piece on the top that you think and perceive to be what is, but if you actually dug deeper, there would be so much more in there that is unpredictable, that is unknown, that is difficult, that is stressful, that is all of those things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's part of what I see my job as for parents, is to help them understand what's underneath, because kids don't always know. We ask our kids and they say, I don't know why I did that. They don't know. So we trust our instinct. We get a little information, which is what I try to give in my podcast, just understanding what's under the iceberg, what's going on. And we do our best. And again, like we said before, we don't have to be perfect. Thank goodness.
No, we just have to do our best. That is I like that line from this podcast today. We have to, as parents, do our best. And if we mess up, it's part of learning. It's how we as parents acknowledge what we've done and be able to move forward in a way that is positive both for ourselves and our kids.
Yeah. And it's how we teach kids how relationships work. Honestly, relationships are not perfect.
Oh, and
we
no,
don't
really?
Need them to think they are.
The perfect relationship. That would be interesting. I think that would actually be boring, is actually what I think it would be,
right?
Personally.
Right. Exactly.
So this is a good segue into sort of resources, things that you think parents should tap into, that you think would be helpful kind of around this executive functioning conversation.
So I love Daniel Siegel. He has a lot of books related to the brain. I'm obviously very interested in the brain and executive functioning. So Daniel Siegel is an author I love. He has a lot of books out there from kids to teens. There's also a book I love for parents of children who struggle with anxiety, which is called The Opposite of Worry. And that's by Lawrence Cohen. Those are two books I often recommend. So, I mean, there's a lot out there, but those are probably the people I recommend the most.
I always say to people the Google rabbit hole when it comes to executive functioning, ADHD, neurodiversity is massive.
Yeah.
And I've certainly been that parent at, 3 or 4 in the morning trying to understand why they had the meltdown I had the day before. And I think for some reason, Google is going to answer my question. It never does.
Right.
But I always
hope.
Right. We hope upon hope. Okay. Rachel, where can people learn more about you and what you do?
So first of all, I'm going to give you for your show notes, if you have them, a video series that I have, if you are raising a child with big emotions. And it's going to be very easy to access because it's going to have your direct link there. And then I have my own podcast. It's called Your Parenting Long Game. And it talks a lot about raising resilient kids and raising kids with big emotions, but also not kids without big emotions. And then I have a Facebook group that goes with that podcast. So I'm all over the place, but I will give you a special video series that you can send to your audience.
Amazing. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for this. I feel like we could go on hours and hours and hours, but we're all busy. We all have things going on. So thank you for this. I hope we connect again, but I really, really appreciate this conversation.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it too.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you are looking for help and support in creating a roadmap to success for your child through challenging times, contact me at access2education.com. I work with all families to help them build power and knowledge in understanding their child's needs and how to build success through advocacy. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Access to Education Toronto. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast so together we can create your roadmap to success.